Hello and welcome to Being Well. I'm Forrest Hansen. If you're new to the show, thanks for listening today. And if you've listened before, welcome back. My guest today is Dr. Meg Jay, a developmental clinical psychologist who specializes in 20-somethings. She's on faculty at the University of Virginia and is the author of a number of wonderful books, including The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter, and How to Make the Most of Them Now, and her new book, The 20-Something Treatment, A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age. So Meg, thanks for doing this with me today. How are you?
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast, actually.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate that. And I'm happy to talk to you. We actually just recorded an episode that's on the things that we wish we knew when we were 20.
Well, I heard that you had recorded it.
Yes,
I'm ready to talk about it.
Awesome.
Let's do it.
Yeah, it was in the process of that I bumped into your work, and particularly your TED Talk, which Why 30 is Not the New 20 is what it was titled. That totally blew up.
Right.
It's become a very, very listened to TED Talk. And it was just so helpful for me as a 36-year-old person to like put that decade of time into context. And also, I probably want to be a parent at some point. And so helping somebody else through that moment in time. And I was wondering, just to start with, what do you think the biggest misunderstanding is about our 20s?
Yeah, well, I love that you said putting it in context, because that's really what my work is all about. So the new book, The 20-Something Treatment, you know, subtitle starts A Revolutionary Remedy, blah, blah, blah. And the revolutionary remedy is it puts mental health in context, in the context of your 20s. It's not just all one size fits all, but let's really understand what's going on with 20-something. So probably the most common two misperceptions, one I tackle in my first book, The Defining Decade, is that your 20s don't really matter and 30s a new 20 and everybody does everything later anyway, so whatever. The 20-something treatment takes on the misconception that your 20s are going to be the best years of your life, that they're going to be a lot of fun, and that 20-somethings who are struggling are just snowflakes or they have serious mental illness, but really normalizing the fact that your 20s are actually an incredibly difficult decade, and they're the mental health low point of life, I'm sorry to say. The good news is that life gets better. You're probably already experiencing that in your 30s. You know, we say the 20s are going to be the best years of your life. I tell my clients, if your 20s turn out to be the best years of your life, something has gone terribly wrong, that you want life to get better as you go.
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience. My 20s
yes.
were good in some ways and really, yeah, really
difficult.
Rocky in other ways. Totally.
Yes.
Which I think is echoed by a lot of people. And one of the things that you hear people say, and maybe we're going to your previous book a little bit here, is some version of, you have so much freedom, you should just enjoy this moment in life. And there's a general tendency, I think, that older people have to kind of minimize the problems of a 23-year-old because they feel to that 56-year-old like just kind of still a pupa, and don't worry, you'll figure it out at some point and it'll all
right.
get easier. What's the actual lived experience that clients tend to bring into your office?
Yeah, so a little spoiler alert for listeners who have 20-something children or 20-somethings in their lives. The worst thing you can say to a 20-something is, oh, you're fine. You've got all the time in the world. You're figured out. It's just not helpful. It's not very specific advice. And so I think the thing to understand about the 20s is, yes, it's a time of, quote, exploration and freedom. But I mean, let's remember, most 20-somethings are broke. It's hard to find jobs. I mean, it's not just like the world is their oyster and they're out there exploring. So it's a really difficult time. But all that freedom also means uncertainty. So jobs are uncertain, relationships are uncertain, cities, friends, mental health, the future, finances, everything is uncertain in your 20s. And the brain hates uncertainty. So the brain is going to read that as danger, as catastrophe, as anxiety, as panic. So it's not a lot of fun to wake up in the morning and not know where you're going to live in 5 years or what you're going to do or if anybody's going to love you, whether you're going to be happy. And, you know, now that the adult milestones are kind of happening later in life, most people don't start waking up kind of knowing, like, I generally know how my life is going to go at this point. That doesn't usually come now until our 30s. Which makes our 20s actually quite difficult. They might sound good to sort of, quote, not have to worry about all that stuff, but 20-somethings are worrying a lot about not having any of that stuff.
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out to me in your work in general and your book in particular is that uncertainty is particularly stressful when we lack confidence in our own abilities. And we had a recent episode on self-abandonment and creating a self-concept as like something from which you can derive safety. Because most of the time, you know, we're social animals. Yeah. And we think about the world as like we're safe or we're capable based on what we're doing with or for other people. Or maybe as a marker of identity, like I am a fill in the blank and therefore I can be safe or comfortable or whatever it is. Exactly. And I just love how you're, how you're locating this, where if you're 23 years old, you don't necessarily have all of those markers that somebody else might have from which you're getting that security. And so you feel kind of unmoored in that sort of a way.
Absolutely. That it's not just, it's uncertainty on the outside of, you know, my job is unstable and the climate is unstable and I haven't found my person. I mean, there's a lot of that on the outside, but there's also so much uncertainty on the inside because people don't, I mean, these are the years where you're building, but that means you don't yet have those sort of internal sources of feeling sure of yourself. I can count on myself that, okay, even if I lose this job, I can get another one. Even if this relationship ends, I've been through this before, that the data points aren't there. So there's just not that internal sense of safety. And that's really what a lot of the work I do with 20-somethings is about, is let's help you sort of get those external and internal sources of security, you know, help you build those skills, job, relationships, friendships, communication, all that. But what happens then, as you well know, is then people internalize it as a sense of, well, I can count on myself. I can't make the world be perfect or certain or go the way, whatever, but I can count on myself. Mm-hmm. And understandably, most 24-year-olds aren't feeling that way yet. So it's very difficult. Every time something goes wrong, it feels catastrophic.
What really stands out to me about your work in general is your emphasis on intentionality and how, yes, we can have a moment in time where we have a lot of freedom or a lot of enjoyment, a lot of exploration, whatever it is that's happening in your life. Maybe you don't have as much of those things because, as you said, you're broke and uncertain and don't know what's going on. But hey, there's probably some of that. But you can do it intentionally. You can do it with a sort of deliberate approach that frames it in the broader context of like hopefully a pretty long life. So stuff isn't just happening to you. And I think that that difference in framing is the real distinction that you make in a lot of your work.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really a sense of, I mean, it's a big shift to go from being in school or college where there's a syllabus and it says do this in this order. And if you do it to this level, you'll get an A or a B. But then suddenly in your 20s, there's no syllabus, there's no schedule, the grading scheme is what you decide it is. And so I think oftentimes 20-somethings are left feeling like, well, I don't really know, I'm kind of waiting for a syllabus, I don't really know how to do this. And just that shift of, oh, actually, this is your life, you get to decide what's on the syllabus, what's an A, what are you trying to achieve, and what are you waiting for? That, you know, most growth and change that happens in adulthood happens from 20 to 30, but it doesn't happen sitting at home usually. You got to sort of get out in the world and interact with experiences and build skills.
So you've got this intersection of factors at this particular moment in time. There's a lot of developmental pressure going on. Your brain is still changing when you're 20 years old. It, you know, this is more complicated than this, but like in general, by the time you hit your late 20s, most people's brains have largely stopped its primary development.
Settled down a little bit.
Neuroscience is complicated. We don't want to generalize too much, but like more or less.
You're right on.
Okay, great. And so that's happening. Then you've got this sort of general uncertainty that people are dealing with. They've acquired a set of skills generally through school, if you live in the Western world. Those skills may or may not have a lot of applicability to the actual work that you're doing in your life these days.
Not, which we can discuss.
Generally not. Right. You've been really good at maybe doing pretty well in school or acing the test or whatever, and you walk out into the world and you discover that all of that accomplishment, that very particular set of skills, may or may not matter that much, actually, it turns out. You may or may not have a secure primary partner, or really any kind of love life at all. I talked to some of my early 20s friends and they're like, man, dating is a jungle out there at best. And mixed with that, you have this underlying sense of self-concept issues. You're still figuring out internally who you are, how you feel, what you value, all of that. Then layered on top of that, for a lot of young people these days, there is a lot of nihilism about the nature of the world, I would say, quite understandably, mm-hmm. whether it is fears about climate change, looking at the broader political climate, the economic world that people are entering these days, a lot of uncertainty there. And so there's this kind of stack of a sort of throw my hands up, like, what are we all doing here, layered on top of all of that. And I'm wondering what the impact of that part of it is, that kind of doomeristic approach that I could hear mm-hmm. sort of come into the way that some of my, like, maybe 23-year-old friends talk about the world, the right. impact that that has on people's mental health and development and just, like, what they can get out of this moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody say, well, what if I do all this and the world ends in 5 years? And, you know, my response is, well, what if it doesn't?
Yeah, what if it doesn't?
You didn't
exactly.
do anything? And then what? Then what are you going to have? So we don't really know. But, you know, I think whether it's the pandemic or recessions or climate change or, you know, I have cancer or my parent is ill. I mean, we just have to say, rather than what is this problem doing to me, what am I going to do about it? And that, you know, all we can do is what we can do and engage with our lives or the communities around us or in whatever way we can touch the world, that's the only way things happen for ourselves or for others. But I think there is sort of a misconception, which I really understand, and I remember feeling this way in my 20s, where you sort of imagine, well, shoot, everybody else's 20s were perfectly set up, but mine have gone sideways. And, you know, it's been this way for many decades now, that 20-somethings sort of graduate into a mess. And, you know, that those inner sense or inner and outer senses of security, the partner, the house, the job, the perspective of having kids, et cetera, you know, they're hanging out at about age 30 and beyond now. So from 20 to 30, you're just in this, you know, very open space, which the brain interprets as very scary and dangerous. And I totally get it. But, you know, one of the skills that people learn by being 20-somethings today is they figure out, how do they say, okay, what am I going to do? What can I do today to feel a little more sure of myself or to improve my situation?
Something that I think connects to this that you've written about is the nocebo effect, which is essentially the opposite of the placebo effect. Could you explain that real quick?
Yeah, I love the nocebo effect. And I need to get that out there more. I should try to do an op-ed on that specific piece.
But I think it's a good one.
So the placebo effect, as you know, I'm sure your listeners know, is it's basically the power of positive expectations, that if you believe that you're probably going to get better and that your situation or your life or your illness or whatever is going to get better, that helps. And it's not just like false, you know, it's not just magical thinking. It actually helps your brain prepare to get better. It helps you engage in getting better, et cetera. So we get that. That's the placebo effect. The nocebo effect is the power of negative expectations. And so this comes up a lot, I think, when young adults are quick to try to look for order amongst the problems that they're having. And they say, I have anxious attachment style, or I have major depressive disorder, or I have generalized anxiety. And, you know, we can talk about whether diagnoses are or aren't helpful, but it's definitely not helpful when people interpret what's happening solely as a problem within them. They're disordered, they're abnormal, their brain is dysfunctional, and it's always going to be that way. That's where the nocebo effect comes in. So oftentimes, you know, I'll hear 20-something say, well, I have this thing, you know, I have anxious attachment, or I'm depressed, I'll always be depressed, when the literature actually suggests otherwise, that most people who are depressed, they're not always depressed, that depression can come and go throughout life, usually because difficult things come and go throughout life. Most of my 20-somethings who tell me they have anxious attachment style do not have an anxious attachment style. They're in a state of anxious attachment. Yeah. They're feeling anxious about their relationship, but this is not their style. So I really try to help 20-somethings kind of slow the roll on the diagnoses. And if they do have them, to say, well, let's look at what this means. That means you check the right boxes in the DSM. We can give you the label, but depression gets better. Anxiety gets better. Attachment changes more in your 20s than any other time in life. So let's not get too hung up on what this means for your, you know, the next 50 years of your life.
I'd love to talk with you about this a little bit, because you're such an expert at it. And I find this whole thing super interesting. And I'm also, I feel a little implicated in it as somebody who creates mental health content. You know, maybe part of the problem a little bit over here. So what I mean by that
well,
is...
Well, you're also part of the solution.
Yes, yes, so, that's what yes, we definitely try to be good about this. But there's been a huge rise in the creation of mental health content in the last 5 to 10 years. Just an enormous explosion in it. And I would argue that by and large, this is a great thing. For starters, free resources are great. It's really good to have access to high quality information. The key part of that is high quality. And there have been a lot of knock-on effects from the spread of mental health information and alongside it, a kind of casual diagnosis that can occur, particularly through platforms like TikTok, where there is a lot of siloing that happens in the content that people receive. Yeah. So you see a person with a particular kind of issue, you feel like you have a sense of empathy for that issue in your own life. They say that they have fill in the blank diagnosis, bipolar, borderline, anxiety, ADHD, autism spectrum disorders, whatever it might be. Therefore, I must have that thing too. That becomes a marker of identity. The thing shifts from something that is happening to you or a temporary experience to, like we were talking about earlier, an aspect of identity. It stops being something that's going on to something that you are. And that shift is a very powerful shift for people, as you know better than I do. So that's my kind of like 1 second treatment of the whole thing.
Yeah,
but I would love your expansion of it.
Say that a whole bunch more times on TikTok. That's perfect. We won't get too into social media, but I will say I'm the last person on earth to finally join social media. And I was like literally 2 weeks ago or something. But I was lying low on social media for a million years because I felt like in general, my clients don't really want to bump into me there.
Makes sense.
And I think that was very true in the early days. But now to your point, this is where the majority of 20-somethings are getting their education and their news and their information. And I firmly believe, this is why I write books, that education is an intervention. That many of my clients, they don't need diagnoses, they don't need medication, they need better information. And I'm not saying everybody, but many, many people, they just need better information. So I'm trying to be part of that better information too, and I know you are. So now I don't remember where we were going with this other than to say, yay us for being part of the better information. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I'll actually ask a question here instead of just like vibing on a topic. But so I'm thinking of my partner here, Elizabeth. So Elizabeth is 32 years old. She's an associate therapist also. Yeah. She exited her grad program about a year and a half ago. She's earning hours towards her license. And she was late diagnosis ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
No brainer. Hole-in-one ADHD diagnosis if she had received it when she was 8 years old. A little bit more complicated, as we know, when you're receiving it when you're 30 years old.
Right.
She started doing a very low dose of Adderall. This was immensely helpful for her from time to time.
I'm sure.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. So there can be huge benefits to people having access to information, having access to a diagnosis, all of that good stuff for some people. But there's a balance there between that and what walks into your office, I would imagine, a lot of the time, which is somebody saying, hey, doctor, I have anxiety disorder and major depressive disorder, and I should probably go on.
Borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder,
bothering here? I'm just messed up. Like, what can I even do? I'm wondering how you think about the balance between those two things.
Yeah.
And then we can talk maybe about helping the person in the second category, which is most people.
I am the first to say, and I say it many times in the 20-something treatment, I have worked with countless 20-somethings and younger than that folks who had ADHD, and a diagnosis and the proper medication is crucial to their survival through school, which is a very shaming and blaming place to be when you have ADHD. And if they manage to get through school, then, you know, the 20s is... you know, it could be a very liberating time when you can sort of have your life match you a little bit, have it match your brain more, and it opens up a whole new space there. But there are certain struggles, you know, I won't try to pin it down exactly. And plus, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm a psychologist, but ADHD, true OCD, of course, bipolar, medication is a must. But in those situations, medication is never the only intervention. It's always medication plus skills. And for, you know, many of the other problems that 20-somethings have, even something you can diagnose in the DSM, major depression, medication may or may not be helpful. It depends on whether the upsides outweigh the downsides or the side effects. And we also have to remember that oftentimes the thing that someone's depressed about, a breakup, is the number one precursor to feeling depressed and being diagnosed with major depression in your 20s. That's going to get better. You want to help somebody learn how to grieve and cope with loss and figure out how to move on. And that's really where the healing comes from, not from the medication per se. So it is, I mean, everybody wants to know, when I was writing the 20-something treatment, my editor was like, yeah, but when do people, they do or they don't get diagnosed or go on medication? And I thought, well, this is not, I can't put that in a book chapter, you know, but, you know, of course the answer is find the best therapist or psychiatrist you can to get the best answer to that question. But this is what's so unfortunate about our mental health system. That is not accessible for most people.
Yeah, totally.
You know, a really qualified professional who can say, yes, you have ADHD, or no, I think you got into some really bad habits in the pandemic and it's, you haven't sort of gotten your life back in order, and let's not jump to conclusions, etc.
If you could teach every 20-something person one thing about like the nature of mental illness, essentially like how it works, what would it be?
I think the biggest misunderstanding is that 20-somethings feel a lot more disordered than they are. And I include people who meet criteria for XYZ, you know, that, you know, I think a lot of folks with ADHD, for example, who have the right diagnosis, they feel more disordered than they should.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of what's going on, even for folks with ADHD or OCD in their 20s, is situational. It will get better. Your skills will get better. You'll be able to surround yourself with the right work for you and the right people for you and the right situations for you. And your mental health can improve. What I really hate to see is 20-somethings sort of, you know, like you said so eloquently, you know, getting a diagnosis and their identity all tangled up together prematurely. Because then what happens is, you know, a sort of assortative mating where we kind of huddle up and cuddle up with people with the same perceived problems. And we forget to connect with people who share our strengths.
If you're like me, you've probably started to pay closer attention to your long-term health as you've aged. Turning 35 was a bit of a wake-up call for me, and I'm always looking for good sources of information, because it's often really difficult to separate fact from fiction when it comes to our physical health. We had Dr. Tim Spector on the podcast a few years ago. He's a professor of genetic epidemiology and the scientific co-founder at Zoe. And the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is truly one of the best resources out there when it comes to this stuff. With the help of world-leading scientists, they help you make smarter health choices every week. And you don't have to just take my word for it. Avid podcast fan Stephanie's Apple review says the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast is a life-changing, science-based, myth-busting podcast. That's a must-listen for anyone who eats food and wants to understand how it affects their body. With the Zoe Science and Nutrition podcast, you can join Stephanie and millions of others transforming their health. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like being well, I think you'll really enjoy the Dr. John Delaney Show. Dr. John's show was recently in the top 5 of all podcasts on Apple Podcasts, which is just an incredible accomplishment, and it speaks to how much value people get out of the show. Dr. John has a PhD in counseling, and he's been working with people for over 20 years, and the show has a very cool format. Real people call into the show, and he walks them through how to navigate a tough situation related to common challenges. Maybe it's something related to their relationships, anxieties, or emotional well-being. He explores a lot of topics that are similar to what we talk about on this podcast, but while we can sometimes be pretty theoretical in nature, the format of John's show just creates a lot of directness and practicality to it. I think it's actually a really nice complement to what we do here on Being Well. No matter what you're going through, the Dr. John Delaney Show is here for you. And if you ever need some advice, you know who to call. Listen to the Dr. John Delaney Show wherever you get your podcasts, or follow the link on our website. So you just said assortative mating, which is a great piece of terminology for starters. And I think it also connects to a very important point that you make in at least the most recent book, I believe also the book before that as well, which is about the strength of weak ties, essentially how we tend to cluster with people, a relatively small group of people, but most of the positive change that happens in people's life tends to come from outside of that group if they want to make a meaningful change, because those outside people have less similarity. And I'm wondering how you think about that and how you help people access those weak ties.
You know, I love you just did something that nobody has done before, and I'm not sure I had consciously done it, is that you just connected the weak ties and the defining decade with part of what I'm arguing for in the 20-something treatment. So I'll explain that to your listeners who were talking inside baseball here. But weak ties are, you know, the people that you don't know well. They're the friend of friend and the neighbor's cousin and your old roommate that you never talk to anymore. They're people outside of the inner circle. And in the defining decade, I talked a lot about how new jobs, new apartments, new dates, new information, new ideas, they come from outside the inner circle. Because the inner circle, we're just chatting with them all the time, same stuff over and over. So we're not learning about new opportunities was really the focus in the defining decade. But you're absolutely right that in the 20-something treatment, something similar goes on with mental health, that if we see ourselves as depressed or as anxious or as eating disordered or whatever, you know, like you said, TikTok is going to silo us that way. But we silo ourselves where we think, well, the only people who can understand me are other people who are depressed or other people who are anxious. And so we, you know, sort of these other pieces of ourselves, our strengths, all the things we're doing right, the places where we're not struggling, those aren't getting the attention and the airtime and sort of the connections outward. The piece of ourselves that we feel is disordered. Even though I do think groups can be very useful for 20-somethings when they're struggling with XYZ, I really caution 20-somethings against making their disorder the basis of their social world and kind of the only way they're working to understand themselves.
Like with anything, there's a balance there. Aspects of identity and being around people who share aspects of identity can be incredibly powerful for people.
Right.
And just to like be supported in that experience, to get a sense of shared empathy, like this is all great. And I really want to emphasize that. And at the same time, I do think that the overall point about get new content in the system if you can is really important, just because if you keep on messing with the same inputs, you're going to have the same outputs over a long period of time, right? You need a little new material in there to kind of zhuzh it up, if nothing else. and that got also, frankly, like a lot harder during the pandemic for a lot of people who were very heavily siloed during a period of time.
Of course. Well, and you know what else I think helps with 20-somethings with that is connecting more with people of other ages, because when you think about it, when you go through school, everybody is like the exact same year and age as you. You know, everybody you know, it's you know, very horizontal. And so I think there's still a little bit of that mentality with, you know, understandably with 20-somethings, they're used to talking to people their age plus or minus 1 year. I'm not even talking about go talk to 50-year-olds. I get it. That may not seem interesting. But just talking to people 5 years older than you are, you know, can be enormously helpful because they've been there recently, but they've found a way to a better spot at work, a different way of viewing their mental health. You know, they're actually having success with partners that you can kind of imagine like, oh, my life might actually head upward from here.
Something we've been talking about throughout in little ways is just like the nature of how we view ourselves, self-concept. And something that's pretty common for people who are 24, 25 years old is some version of what they might call like having an identity crisis. And there are kind of two reasons that people can have an identity crisis. And help me out here as well if you'd like to add anything onto this list. The first one is that they don't have a lot of what you call identity capital, which is basically the stuff that you accrue to figure out who you are. And the second reason that somebody could have an identity crisis, and I've really bumped into this one in my life, is because they feel a sense of tension between who they are and what they really want to do and what they feel like they should be doing or where they feel like they should be in life. That can be a really hard experience to go through. And for people who are in maybe that first bucket we can start with, the like lack of accruing identity capital, what are some of the things that can help out with that?
Yeah, so the identity capital is a concept, not mine, James Cody from Canada, but I popularized it, I think, in the defining decade. But it's really about you can't figure out, you know, I think 20 somethings think I'm going to figure out who I'm going to be once and forever, and then I'll go do it. But you actually can't figure that out without doing stuff.
Oh, that's a great point. So like the direction's wrong. You know, the idea is that you'll have the thought and that'll lead to an action. But the reality is you need to do the action and then you'll figure out how you feel about it.
Right. And we know that on average now, speaking, you know, of the uncertainty, I don't remember if I rambled off this factoid earlier, but 20-somethings will have 9 jobs by the age of 35. Wow. So there's a lot there out there.
I was pretty close to that.
Theoretically. I mean. Yeah. Oh, I think I had 9 jobs at one time at one point when I was in my 20s. So I encourage 20-somethings. Plus, let me also add, most end up in careers or positions that they'd never heard of when they were in college or that didn't exist. So that asking a 20-year-old or even a 25-year-old, what are you going to be always and forever? They don't even know what they don't know in terms of what's possible. So it's the answer is always, what do you think is some useful capital? What are the skills or experiences that you think you need next? And go do that for a year. Then after a year, figure out, do I need more of that? Do I need to pivot and get some different identity capital? That if you go through your 20s basically building skills, earning identity capital, then this will build to something, to, you know, your identity. But you can't really figure it out the other way around. I mean, we know that the learning curve in your 20s maps on to your earning curve in your 30s and beyond. And as a psychologist, I'm not just about the money. I also mean earning in terms of confidence, competence, et cetera, et cetera. So my advice to 20-somethings is just get out there and learn and earn in terms of identity capital, and that will compound.
I don't know quite the right way to ask this question. So again, maybe you'll kind of help me out with it here.
Go for it.
Yeah, where there's this sort of this tension that comes up, and maybe this is in a way we're talking to different approaches, different schools of psychology in some sense, mm-hmm. where some people have what I would describe as more of an action orientation. You know, hey, go out into the world, get some experiences. Those experiences will feed your behavior and all of these positive feedback loops. You know, over time, you'll feel better about yourself because you're doing stuff. That's really great. Somebody could be listening to this and think to themselves some version of, that sounds really good, but I just really struggle to do that. There's some mm-hmm. kind of initial spark that people often need to move into that behavior. And then once they can access the behavior, everything does change for them. Mm-hmm. But you got to have that spark too. It's this combination of these two things. So there's this sort of mysterious pixie dust that can kind of happen to people where one day they just sort of wake up and all of a sudden they can do the thing. Like you tell the story, I'm going to butcher this, but you tell a story in the book where you were working with somebody who thought that they were failing out of a class and they were paralyzed about going to the class. And then one day they were able to go to that class. They were able to open the door and walk into the room.
Mm, mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think helps people, what they need to do, what they need to accrue, what helps them get to that point where they can like flip the switch in that way.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm remembering the person I was talking about in the book, and I actually have someone in my practice right now who's struggling to get her first job since the pandemic. I mean, she was working remotely, and we can talk about how lousy that usually ends up feeling for 20-somethings. But anyway, she's trying to get back in the game, and it's very hard because she feels out of the game, and she's upset and crying every day. And, you know, I think the people around her are sort of alarmed that she's crying every day. And I feel a lot of empathy, yet that's also where change comes from, of that this is no good. This doesn't feel good. This isn't working. I think this is sort of what's making her realize, yeah, as scary as it is to get out there and try to get that job, avoiding it is not working at all. And so I think that's what happened with the person you're talking about from the 20-something treatment. He felt like had failed at school and was a disappointment, and that had never happened before, and wanted to avoid and avoid and avoid. But that was, you know, making him feel very depressed and stay in bed. And, you know, he did drag himself into my office on several occasions. And I think it was through our conversations. And again, I didn't say anything magical. I have no magic passwords, but I just kept saying, you just got to show up. You got to walk through the door. You've got to go talk to your professor. Just tell him what's going on. And after a few times, he believed me, I guess, and went to try it. And then of course, the professor said, oh, gosh, I struggled like this and worse in college, and I'm happy to help. And just that data point, that experience. I mean, it's like, how do people have that first win, that first data point where they learn, oh, it's okay to ask for help. This will go well. Or, oh, my boss sent me an angry email, but I didn't get fired. It's okay. You know, that we all have those first experiences where our brain learns, okay, not so bad. I can keep doing this. But you're right. It's that first getting out that's a challenge. That's often where I come in, or hopefully where my books and your podcast come in.
Yeah, I think that you are speaking to something here that's really important, which is that relational aspect of it. That person had an interaction with you that went well. You know, you gave them some good emotional support, and maybe they needed multiple cycles of that, as most people do, to get to a point where they felt like they had accrued the safety, essentially, like built up the safety experiences to have enough of a shield around them when they walked into the room to protect themselves emotionally. And so maybe one of the kind of lessons from that is looking for different kinds of positive relationship. Some people can get them from a therapist because they have access. As you were saying earlier, access is really hard. So there are other ways that you have to look around for that kind of supportive relationship. And most people can find, you know, one or two if they really go looking for them.
And then it's interesting. I mean, people are amazing. I 100% agree with you that relationships are key, but because not everyone can have one with a therapist, you know, part of what I do is really help readers, clients, students, anyone have better relationships with others, the people in their lives, friends, family, partners, what have you. You know, I say if I'm the best relationship in my client's life, then I'm not doing my job. But, you know, ideally they would have people in their lives that say, you know, go in there, talk to your professor. You can do this. It's going to be okay. They shouldn't need me. And so I try to help people cultivate those relationships outside my office.
Do you think that there is a common behavior that people in their 20s have that tends to get in the way of that?
Avoidance. And it's avoidance. And it's really not necessarily a 20-something behavior, but it's the most common response to uncertainty and anxiety, which we've already talked about. Uncertainty feels like danger. When we feel danger, we tend to avoid. And so people kind of hide behind their computer or stop going to class or don't ask someone out, or they hang out on porn instead of braving real life relationships. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of avoidance that happens in our 20s, especially. So I think a lot of what I do is helping people figure out, what are you trying to accomplish in these ways, and how can we help you accomplish that in a little bit more of a lived, interactive way?
What do you think helps people manage social anxiety in that way?
Well, that's a great topic, because I've got to do the context always. So I don't even like the term social anxiety, not surprisingly. So I often, when my clients who often come in and they say, I have social anxiety. It's this thing I have. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, what does that mean? And so they say, well, I feel really nervous.
Sorry, you got me mid-swallow there. That was very funny. No, it's... go ahead. That just speaks to something that I think is like such an accurate summary of so many of the issues that we have in the mental health world these days. Like, what does that mean? Like, what are those words?
What does that mean to you? Like, what have you heard that mean? So they'll say, oh, well, I feel really nervous before I give a presentation at work. Or, gosh, I feel so stressed when someone doesn't text me back. Or if I go to a party and I don't know people, I really like I have a drink first. Or sometimes I'll say something in a meeting or on a date, and then I can't stop thinking about how stupid it was. And so everything they're saying, of course, I'm like, done that. Welcome to being human. And I try, of course, not surprisingly, to reframe it with my 20-somethings, unless they have a clear, lifelong, debilitating pattern of anxiety in relationships, which most do not. I try to say, you know, what if we think about this as social uncertainty, that, you know, you're not sure if this person likes you, and you're not sure how to talk to people you don't know, and you're not sure why somebody didn't email. Like, what if we just call it that and not get too hung up on this being a disorder? couple of other interesting factoids about social anxiety. It is the fastest growing diagnosis amongst young adults for the reasons I just said, because it's not social anxiety. It's social uncertainty. And that's normal, especially when you're in your 20s and you don't know who your friends are and you're not great at speaking up in meetings and you don't feel safe at work, etc. So about 50% of young adults meet the criteria for social anxiety, which tells you that it's not a disorder. I mean, we won't get in the weeds on that for your poor listeners. And then most will not meet the disorder, not meet the criteria anymore, you know, as they get older, which tells me this is a normal struggle of development. So the first thing I do, which is, you know, what I often do, is I normalize it like I just did. Oh, my goodness, this is social uncertainty and we feel uncertain. And of course, your brain doesn't like that. It perceives it as danger, but that doesn't mean it is dangerous or that you don't have the skills. You just don't, you know, you just need more practice. And so then it's trying to figure out, what do they need more practice with? Not getting a reply on a text and not catastrophizing that, just waiting to find out if, oh yeah, the person said they were driving and couldn't get back to me, versus they hate me, they're not going to ask me to things, et cetera. Or do you need more experience giving presentations? I mean, I've sent more than one young adult to Toastmasters and said, well, go practice giving presentations and then you'll feel less stressed and anxious about it. Although it's normal. I mean, to this day, when I give a talk, I feel a little bit nervous beforehand because that's the body saying, like, you care, get ready, pay attention.
As a quick note about one aspect of what you were saying there, I did research for an episode looking up the statistics on anti-anxiety medication some time ago. And at the time that I looked it up, it was one of the least effective forms of medication that we have by percentage. And it's also 100%. One of the most increasingly prescribed ones in the United States. And that's a bad intersection right there.
Well, I'll tell you another bad intersection. It's one of the most addictive. And so, you know, I talk about this in the 20-something treatment. Benzos should not be prescribed by general practitioners, and that young adults do not understand that they're short acting, they're habit forming. And so they go from, I took one a day to I took three a day to I took 10 a day. It's really becoming a big problem. They're actually second only to opioids in overdoses, and the people most likely to wind up in the ER with overdoses are young adults, and only about half of them meant to do that. Their other are just taking too many. They don't understand. I don't know if their doctors don't understand. They're not supposed to be taking them for long periods of time in high doses. So anti-anxiety meds, like, we don't have great anti-anxiety options. And some people, of course, do need those, but many, many 20-somethings need to understand that it's normal to feel quite anxious much of the time, and that it passes, and that we can kind of feel more sure of ourselves, and then we're better able to handle it when it does happen.
A major source of anxiety for people of all ages, but maybe particularly in our 20s, is their relationships. You have a whole section of the book. I would argue you have like two or three whole sections of the book that are dedicated to relationships in different kinds of ways. I think one of them is titled something like How to Social, How to Love, others How to Sex, like all, you know, all these major issues that people have. And that's a core arena for people.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, of the people who like walk into your office, is there a common theme that tends to come out of people's mouths around issues related to relationships, like a common fear maybe?
Yeah, the fear is that they're not liked or loved. They'll never be liked or loved. End of conversation.
Classic. You know, gotta love it. It's nice when there's a good unifying principle here to work with. Yeah.
So, right. And again, I guess we haven't really talked about this, but I'm all about putting mental health in the context of the 20-something brain and life.
Yes.
And 20-somethings are more likely to interpret things negatively and to feel negatively than older adults. They just have more negative soup, you know, going on with, if they see something that's uncertain, they're going to assume the worst. Once something bad does happen or that they perceive as bad, they're going to feel worse about it than older adults. And so, of course, whether it's social media or a party they went to or a meeting at work or a date they went on, they're going to interpret these things as, that person doesn't like me, I'm never going to be liked. That person doesn't love me, I'm never going to be loved. And so a lot of what I do with people is just help them shift that to, well, really? I mean, is this all the data we have here? You know, has anybody ever liked you before? Is there anything you can do to change how much people like you? Or could you kind of choose your partners a little bit differently? So it's kind of trying to take that 20-something assumption that the way life is now is the way it's always going to be, because empirically speaking, that's not correct.
As we develop greater competency in life, we start looking for different people. We start hunting for different experiences. Right. We gain more confidence in ourselves, pursuing different kinds of partners, get trapped in some of those old patterns a little bit less. I can definitely speak to some of that. And I'm wondering how improving self-love, self-respect affects the ways that those relationships tend to play out for people.
Oh, I mean, I think it absolutely does. And you probably have gotten this from me already. I don't really give people empty reassurance of, oh, yeah, you're amazing, people are going to love you, because their brains don't believe that. I mean, that's just, you know, this person who's, she's paid to say that. Of course she's going to say that. So I really try to help people. Most 20-somethings have more strengths and more successes, more identity capital, more positive relationships, more all the good stuff than they're able to recognize and really own. And so I try to slow people down and ask them for more evidence or other pieces of evidence of, well, I mean, is this really true? Tell me about some of your other friendships. Tell me about your relationships with your parents. Tell me about how this went, or college, or this aspect of work, whatever the case may be, so that they can spend more time in their brain on some data that is kind of disproving what their brain is trying to do, which is imagine the worst, jump to the worst conclusion, but to say, maybe you're not as screwed up as you think you are. Maybe you're actually doing okay. Maybe this is the way it feels to be a 20-something, and that you can just get better from here. I was actually on a podcast the other day with somebody who said, well, I have a 20. I was saying that 20s are the hardest years of your life and it'll get better. And she said, well, my 20s are actually pretty good and I'm terrified everything is going to go sideways. And I said, well, why would that happen? I mean, you managed to make it good in one of the hardest decades there is. So I feel that you will, you know, let's talk about what did you build and how did you do that? So you're going to lose all those skills in the next 5 or 10 years. I would just assume you're going to become better at these things as you go. So, but it's a 20-something brain thing. And it's like you're talking about, there isn't that sense of security or safety of, not everybody's going to like me, but I know how to find the people who are right for me, the right jobs, the right friends, the right partners. And I can keep doing that. And if things go sideways, I can do it again.
If somebody walked into your office and said some version to you of, I don't know if people call you Meg or Dr. J or what the lingo
is. It varies.
It varies. All right. So, yeah, you know, Dr. Meg, I'm feeling really stuck right now. And I'm feeling really stuck right now because I'm having a hard time in my relationship. And I feel like I just keep on going around and around the merry-go-round with kind of the same sort of person with the same kind of problems. And I don't feel like I can do a lot about it. And I feel like this is just the way that I am. Like I am this kind of person. And I don't know what to do. And I just feel very like stuck or trapped in that pattern of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
How would you start exploring that with somebody?
Well, I mean, this is not a transcript of what I would do in session, but
yeah,
general themes would be, I mean, true to form, I would, because this actually takes us to the placebo effect or the power of positive expectations. We know that one reason that people get better in therapy is not because they believe a sugar pill, you know, it's because they believe that they can get better and that life gets better. And so I usually do some normalizing and some shifting of expectations around, you know, who people are in their 20s does not actually tend to be who they are forever. So let's not go assuming that. So I try to loosen up the expectations around this is who I'm always going to be. And, you know, I let them see that I have hope. I expect positive growth and change. I would be shocked if this person did not grow and change for the better over the next, you know, 1, 3, 5 years. So I try to get that out there of I'm thinking the best here. And not because I expect that to be the end of the story, but because I think that's a good place to start. And then I even though, as you can tell, I am a very action-oriented, what can we do person, I actually usually start with curiosity. If I really want to understand why the person is doing what they feel like they need to do, well, why do you feel like you need to be with this kind of partner? What kind of partner do you keep choosing? When did this start? Where did that come from? Why do you think they keep going? What do you think would happen if you did it differently? So I just try to be really curious and really understand the problem before I go suggesting a solution. And then often the solution is, what can you do differently? Even if it's one small thing at a time, just anything. What can you do differently? If that's what you want to be in a different situation, well, what can you do differently to make your situation different?
The last section of your book is How to Purpose. I thought it was really interesting how you emphasized that. As you know, I co-authored a book with my dad. You only get so many chapters. We did ours at a 12 chapter structure. You just get 12.
Right.
You gotta pick 12.
Right.
You can't pick 20 topics. You just gotta pick 12.
Oh, I know. But you bring up a great point. You've got to choose your real estate, and then you can't put everything in there.
Yeah.
And so everything I've chosen, I feel strongly about.
Yeah. Totally. And so you're allocating one of your 12 precious children of your chapters or whatever it is
right.
to how to choose purpose, which is on the scale of, like, if we do some Maslow's hierarchy going on here or something, you know,
exactly.
Self-actualization on the one
it's
hand.
At the top.
At the
right.
very top.
Yeah.
On the
yeah.
other hand, I think that for a lot of people who are 24 years old, the notion of, like, life purpose feels like a pretty big and airy and diffuse thing. When I'm worried about the problem on the ground right now, which is that I'm getting C's, or it's that I don't have a functional relationship, or it's that, you know, the job market is a nightmare and I've sent in 100 resumes and I've gotten zero responses, even though I should be on paper a very accredited person.
Right.
And so I just thought that it was so interesting, including just in my own life, where I feel like one of the big struggles that I had for a really long time was related to fulfillment more than it was related to any kind of specific on the ground problem. And that really connects to that overall sense of meaning and purpose that a person can cultivate through their lives. So I just wanted to tug on that thread, and I'm wondering why you wanted to highlight that as an issue, and yeah, just the thoughts you have about it.
Yeah, thank you for raising that. So it's the last chapter in the I have like, as you really did your homework,
yeah.
my how-tos. I love it that you did your homework so well. So there are 12, and it's the last one from a Maslow's hierarchy perspective of, I was kind of trying to say, this is important. It's probably going to be the last thing that you get to. And a lot I'm doing in that chapter is normalizing not having found it yet. That a lot of 20-somethings are like, I don't have purpose. I don't have meaning. Well, the data show that most people around the world find purpose and meaning through work and love. And as we have discussed, work and love can be a bit of a mess in your 20s and often don't feel solidified until you're 30 or beyond. So if you don't have purpose yet, don't panic. This is one of the last things to come your way, and that's okay. And at the same time, there's always, if you want more purpose in your life, it's all around you. You just choose to intersect with it. So, you know, I actually had a class on this, and the students had to sort of go out and do something that they felt like would create more purpose and meaning in their lives. And so it was, you know, one started, I think, like a Latino neighborhood organization, and another was having conversations about Israel and Palestine. And this was, you know, before last year. And another was, you know, really focusing on having better relationships because she had grown up in a family where there weren't great relationships. And that was very purposeful and meaning for her to focus on that. But just to try to help young adults see, you know, purpose is something that you work toward. Don't panic if you don't have it yet, but you can always be intersecting with something meaningful if you choose to do so. And that's a choice that we make sometimes through our career, sometimes through our relationships, sometimes through hobbies, sometimes through volunteering, sometimes through any conversations that we have. But I just wanted to say, I hear you that you're worried you don't have this, but don't panic. It's usually the last piece, but you can go ahead and start feeling more of a sense of that, because it's hard for 20-somethings at what most of the world finds purpose through, work and love. where our milestones are now, they don't have it. And so, I mean, I'm not saying kids are the ultimate purpose and meaning, but if you have kids, you definitely have a lot of perspective real quick that no matter what happens at work, not the end of the world. My kids are still okay. They're breathing. I'll figure this out. And, you know, 25-year-olds don't have that sense of purpose or perspective of, you know, hey, I got to get up every day and make this happen. There are people counting on me. Mm. So they can feel pretty unmoored. There's also the piece in there about religion that, you know, by and large, fewer young adults than ever identify with a particular religion, which used to be a kind of a ready-made source of purpose and meaning. And they don't have that now.
As a relatively non-religious person, as somebody who doesn't have an inclination toward that and has never really had an inclination toward that, there have been many times where I've reflected and kind of had some moment of like, man, it would be nice to have a sort of simple thing to plug into, to be like,
tell me
go
the
with
purpose.
God, like have a good day and you know, going up to heaven, the whole thing. There's this incredible interaction that my dad's family is from North Dakota originally, a bunch of ranchers. And we went out there to visit extended family. And I was talking with my great aunt about something, and she was an older lady. And she basically, I sort of asked some version of a reflecting on life question or thinking about how you're feeling. And she was a much older person, 92 years old, something like that at the time. And she was like, well, you know, I think it's going to be fine because I'm going to die and then I'm just going to go be with God and it's all going to work out. And I was like, wow, oh man, if I could have that,
that'd be nice.
That's some peace of mind right there. So no, I just do think it is an interesting piece of the puzzle here for sure.
It is. And actually, that came up a lot in the class. I taught a class on this. And, you know, I think a lot of young adults, a lot are saying, gosh, I kind of wish I had that. This would be so much easier. And I don't know if it would or it wouldn't, but that's the fantasy. There's a syllabus out there for me somewhere.
Yeah, I think the fantasy of it sounds nice. And you drill down a layer or two and things get a little bit more complicated pretty rapidly.
Of course, right.
I'm wondering, Meg, if somebody comes into your office and is like, I feel like I have a purpose problem, if they have the ability to access that language, or you just kind of identify in them, well, a lot of stuff is happening here, but it doesn't feel like there's any unifying movement in a direction that feels really meaningful for this person. Is there any kind of a process that you would go through with somebody to start to try to figure that out?
That's a good question. There are people who say, hey, I'm good with a bunch of stuff going on and I don't need a sense of meaning and purpose. But I think if the person brought that in as a presenting problem of, I've got all the stuff, I checked all the boxes, but there's no meaning and purpose, I would, like I said before, I would get real curious about that. You know, what's going on that, okay, let's say the person has work and love, which usually are some starter sources of purpose. I would want to understand what's going on that they're not feeling the purpose there. You know, I don't think you have to go sort of start a nonprofit or get up on a pulpit to have meaning and purpose. I would really want to understand what's happening that you're not feeling it in work or love or work outside of work. You know, is there something that needs to change about your job or how you spend your time outside of your job or ways to deepen your relationships? I would probably start there of why is that feeling so meaningless?
For a lot of people, I wonder if there's a comparison issue here fundamentally, like we're maybe told the story that in order to have a fulfilling life, you do need to be at that pulpit or be starting that nonprofit or whatever it might be for that person. And so you wake up at 28 or 36, you know, for me, and you start looking around and going, wow, you know, I haven't done that thing. Does that mean that I'm not living the life that I was supposed to live? And so I do think that that's a big theme for people. And so I wonder about the stories that we tell about this and normalizing those a little bit or normalizing that experience.
I mean, I think a good one is that a good thing to normalize is that not everybody's job is going to feel meaningful or purposeful, nor does it have to. I mean, you know, that sometimes people can connect, you know, the coding that they're doing with this cool project that has a big impact. Other times people feel like, whatever, I code, I come home, I get paid. And then they look for meaning elsewhere. And that's fine. There's no one, you know, not everybody's job needs to feel like, you know, it's changing the world for us to feel satisfied or to feel like there's meaning and purpose. Some people you know, just want to do their job, and meaning and purpose is what they do for their family or what they do for their kids or what they do for their community. I mean, it's, I think it's really about, like you said, not getting too hung up on narratives about what should be happening, about what we think other people are doing, but to figure out, well, what does that mean for you to have meaning and purpose? And let's figure out how we can help you get it.
I'm imagining the perspective of somebody who is in their early 30s, let's say, if not their early 40s, and they're listening to a conversation like this, which really focuses on some version of this is a moment in life that is very important. It really sets you up for the rest of your life. Here are all of these things that you can do during it to maximize the value that you get out of this. And they're looking back and going, man, I did not do that. and there's this feeling of a lost moment in time, a lost opportunity. I just didn't really squeeze the juice out of it in the way that I could have, maybe. I got to imagine that that's something that you bumped into on at least the book tour, if not in your office. And I'm wondering how you respond to that.
Yeah. Oh, I've bumped into it over email many times.
People
email and say, oh no, I read your book and I'm 35.
Now I feel like a mess. What am I doing? You know,
totally. Yeah. So a few things. When people email me and say, oh, if only I'd had this book when I was in my 20s, now I'm 35. I mean, both of them are really the science and the art of adult development. And there's nothing in the book that no longer applies at 30 or 40 or 50. I'm just a 20-something expert. So I'm sort of the person who's, I'm getting it out there at the first possible moment of adult development. But, you know, I've had one thing I loved was someone told me that they said they went to their, wait, I got to do the math on this. It would have been their 20th college reunion. And they ran into their a friend that they hadn't seen in many, many years. And the person said, oh my gosh, I just read this book. It rocked my world. It changed my life. The person's 41. And my friend said, what was it? He said, the defining decade. And I just loved it that the person read the book and didn't say like, oh shoot, I'm over 30. Mm. None of this applies. Like he got it, that it's still about identity capital. It's still about weak ties. If we go over to the 20-something treatment, it's still about purpose and meaning. It's still about, you know, when we're feeling depressed or anxious or stressed, those are feelings we're often saying, what's wrong? What's going on? What needs to change? What skills do you need to be working on? Not you're a disordered, abnormal person and you can never be well. So anyway, I tell people, just block out the 20-something word and keep reading. It all still applies to you.
Yeah.
So that's what I tell people. And I do get those emails from time to time. But I think if I wrote a book that was, you know, for everybody between 20 and 100, no one would ever read it because, it doesn't have a target or sort of a, you know, that's my context is the 20s.
Totally. And one of the things that I think is maybe just really important to say here at the end that I certainly experienced, your life is not over. Your life is not messed up if you hit 30 and you feel like you don't have this stuff figured out. People can change at any moment in time. The moment that you have available to you is right now. The past is the past. Say whatever phrase works for you here.
No,
that's just, it's deeply true. And like, yes, the earliest moment is always the most high leverage moment, right? When you're 20, the highest leverage moment is when you're 20. When you're 45, the highest leverage moment is when you're 45. That's the way it works.
Absolutely. Now is always the time.
Yeah.
100%. And, you know, I will say that there's this factoid that I often bring up, which is 80% of life's most defining moments take place by age 35, which makes sense when you think about all those adult milestones. Yeah. Most of them get banged out by around 35. Although, you know, in the 21st century, we're knocking on the door 35 most of the time. So actually on a recent social media post, I posted a picture of myself at 35, getting my PhD diploma, and I was humongously 9 months pregnant. And I was saying, look at me, I'm squeezing in two big ones right under the wire. I did not have it all done at 30, not even close. But what I kind of talked about in that social media post is those projects where I'm having my moment, I'm pregnant, I've got my diploma. Those things did start in my 20s. I decided to start studying for the GRE. I decided to start looking for grad schools. I decided to go this direction with my career. I decided to stop living with this person and start looking for a partner that would be better for me. That all those things started. But if you had asked me at 30, none of them were done. So I wouldn't have, you know, I wasn't done, but I had started. But because you can't see the result, you feel like at 30 you're empty-handed. You're not empty-handed. It's just still in progress.
To use my dad as an example here, he wrote his first, what I would call, successful book in 2009. That's when he was in his mid-50s. It was Buddha's Brain. I had almost, I was almost graduated from college, and he was 56 years old or something like that when that book came out. And then that book took several years to really kind of go anywhere in terms of a public perspective. He was a slow burner.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I love that.
So like that's what happens, you know, but maybe to your point, he got his license when he was, I think, like 35, 36, 37, somewhere in there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so there was some build happening, but just sometimes these things take time. Different life courses for different people. That's the way it goes.
Frankly, everything takes time, right? So that is the way it is. I wrote The Defining Decade at 40, but I wrote it about what I'd been doing for the past 10 years. So I had to get out there and do stuff to have things to write about.
Well, Meg, thanks so much for doing this with me today. Yeah. This was a great conversation. I totally enjoyed it.
Me as well.
Really enjoyed my conversation today with Dr. Meg Jay, the author of The 20-Something Treatment and The Defining Decade. And we began the conversation with me asking Meg what she thought the biggest misconception was that most people tended to have about our 20s. And she talked about a couple of things. The first thing that she mentioned was how many people approach our 20s like they're kind of this bonus decade that people get. You can just kind of figure things out. It's all going to be okay. Kick the can down the road. The second big misconception that people have is that your 20s is this time of ultimate freedom and enjoyment, that this is the best decade of your life. When the truth is that for most people, your 20s is, if anything, probably going to end up being the worst decade of your life. It's when you have the most uncertainty, the fewest resources, and when things often feel kind of chaotic and unpredictable. And that chaos and unpredictability leads to a lot of painful emotions, painful thoughts and feelings that you may or may not have the tools yet to know how to deal with effectively. Then there are a few things that make it even more complicated. First, older adults tend to minimize the struggles and challenges of people in their 20s. And then second, we have a lot of narratives about the way that our 20s are supposed to look or supposed to work that can lead to people feeling small and insecure by comparison to that story. You see the image that gets projected onto social media of things being a certain kind of way, and you assume that you're just supposed to have it all figured out. And then there's this tension between, well, have fun during your 20s, and also, if you don't have it figured out when you're 30, wow, your life is over now. Now, we know that that's just not true. Change happens for people wherever they are right now. Today is the best moment of intervention that you have available to you. And most people are not going to have everything figured out by the time that they hit 29. We then talked for a little while about uncertainty and self-concept. Uncertainty is a stressor for everybody, but it's really a stressor for people who do not have a concept of themselves as somebody from which they can derive safety. Somebody who can meet challenges as they come up, can overcome different kinds of difficulties, and generally, you know, make things work regardless of what's going on around them. That self-concept is based on experiences of doing that, by and large, for people. It's hard to believe that about yourself if you don't have a lot of experience of things going pretty well for you. And people who are in their 20s generally haven't accrued that many experiences of that so far. So that's one of the reasons that uncertainty can feel so stressful for younger people. And that stress, that discomfort, which is often married with a lot of difficult experiences that we have growing up, experiences of things not going well in our relationships, of school being challenging, of the transition into the quote-unquote real world being very difficult for people often. When we pair those struggles with the incredible rise in mental health information that's out there through podcasts like this one, through social media, particularly TikTok, that can lead to people going down a rabbit hole of self-diagnosis that can be a really mixed bag. There has been an enormous increase in diagnosed disorders, particularly in young people, over the last 10 years. Some of this is probably just an accurate correction on what was previously a lot of underdiagnosis of various ailments. For example, ADHD and autism spectrum disorders, particularly in women. but it's also tied to the pathologization of totally normal human experiences. As we talked about during the conversation, it is normal to feel anxiety, and it's particularly normal to feel a lot of anxiety in your 20s. So just because you experience a lot of anxiety does not mean that you have a diagnosable anxiety disorder or that you should be put on medication for it. And as always, there's a real balance there. I'm partnered with a person who has received enormous benefit from taking certain kinds of medication, who has had just a transformative experience based on receiving a diagnosis that validated her experience of the world in a really meaningful way and allowed her to connect with other people who had a similar experience and to feel seen in that. Like, that's immensely helpful for people. But it also makes a lot of sense for us to be very careful about mental health terminology. And when we start to frame an experience that we're having, particularly an emotional experience, as an aspect of identity, as something we are rather than something that's happening to us, that's going to naturally change over time, things get very entrenched very quickly. And it can be really difficult for people to dig themselves out of some patterns that they've created based on the perception of themselves as having an unchangeable problem, as opposed to just a naturally changeable experience that's going to go up and down over the course of a life. We then talked for a little while about the strength of weak ties, and then alongside that, the importance of developing identity capital. Identity capital is all of the stuff that goes into our identity, that builds up our sense of who we are. If you get a job, that's an aspect of identity capital. If you have a certain kind of relationship with friends out in the world that fills you up, that's a kind of identity capital. This is all the stuff that goes into our self-concept. If you're looking for something truly new in life, if you're looking to create a different outcome that's tied to a new process for you, it's more likely to come from a weak tie than a strong tie. Think of your relationships like a series of concentric circles going out from you. At the closest little circle on the inside is your best friends, your family members, people like that. One circle out, your more distant friends, a circle out from that, a person that you bumped into in class once, and so on and so on. We tend to spend the most time with that core group of people, but research shows that that core group of people tends to be pretty homogenous. They either look like us or talk like us or think like us. And if you're looking for something truly new, it's probably going to come from outside that inner circle. It's probably going to come from the friend of the friend that you haven't even bumped into contact with yet. And it's easy for us to get stuck in a rut based on repeated association with a small and pretty insular group of people. Now, accessing those weak ties can be really difficult for people because we tend to bump our head into a lot of avoidance behaviors. It's scary to interact with people you don't know as well. And this gets even more complicated when we start self-diagnosing with things like social anxiety. And I asked Dr. Meg how she helps people flip the switch where they can finally have that moment where they start moving into the actions that lead to different results for them. And she had a really interesting answer to it, which was in some ways kind of almost implicit in what she was saying, where she built up the strength of the relationship with the people that she was working with. She really fed them. She gave them an alternative way of thinking about it, a different way of looking at it, and really more than anything, kind of just validated their experience relationally. And based on enough of that, enough reassurance, enough positive relating, some real Carl Rogers stuff, if you're into that humanistic psychology, they were able to finally have that moment where they could turn the doorknob and step into the room in a different kind of way. And I've always been really fascinated by that flip the switch moment, what really does get people to a place where they can take the first action that all of the other actions then cascade from. And man, we've asked that question to almost everybody who's come on the podcast. And man, it's a really hard one to answer. It seems like it's this sort of ineffable thing. In the last part of the episode, we talked about building strong relationships and meaning and purpose. These topics are really linked. A lot of the time, our feeling of meaning and purpose comes from feeling like we have stronger relationships. And I really appreciated how Dr. Meg spoke at the end to that feeling that many people have of not having used their time well, a kind of judgment that can emerge inside of us that we didn't get everything that we could out of a particular moment in time. Most people do not figure out their purpose in life by the time that they're 30 years old. I'm 36, and I don't feel like I figured mine out. A lot of people listening to this are probably 45 or 55 or 65, and they're going, man, I don't know if I figured mine out. And that's really okay. We are all works in progress here. We are all in a constant state of figuring it out. That is the human experience. And when we get fed this model of the way that things are supposed to look from the tiny, tiny, tiny subset of the population where things actually look that way for them, it can so distort our perception of the way life really is for most people. The way life really is includes a lot of uncertainty and anxiety and fear and avoidance and concern about the way that things are going to turn out tomorrow. And that's really okay. And it's one of the reasons that I talk about acceptance and agency so often on the podcast, right? We accept all of these things that we truly do not have a lot of control over. And this funny thing happens, to paraphrase Carl Rogers, the curious paradox is when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. And by refocusing over and over again on the things that we actually have control over, we end up getting so much more out of our lives. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Dr. Meg J. Again, she's the author of the new book, The 20-Something Treatment. For me, as possibly a future parent, I'm going to refer back to it. I think that if you know somebody who's in their 20s, if you're in your 20s right now, if you want to get some good perspective on adult development in general, it's a really great book, and I would really recommend it to people. If you've made it this far and you are not subscribed to the podcast, wow, you should really subscribe to it. I would appreciate it, and it would really help us out. Also, if you're listening to it, we have a YouTube channel if you want to watch us on YouTube. And hey, if you're watching on YouTube and you happen to not know about it, we have a podcast. If you prefer to listen sometimes, if you're on a walk, driving around, whatever it is, and YouTube isn't so great for that kind of a thing, you might want to try listening through your podcast player of choice. If you'd like to support us in other ways, you can find us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/beingwellpodcast. And for just a few dollars a month, you'll receive a bunch of bonuses. This can include things like transcripts of all of our podcasts and ad-free versions of the episodes. Until next time, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.